Good morning, 8:11 here on KGGF. 58 degrees right now in Coffeyville. We are continuing our chat with Jesse Gimler from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And we have a couple different topics this segment, but one of those, you said you got a new puppy.
I sure did.
So what kind of dog?
Golden Retriever.
Oh my goodness. How old?
It is now 3 months.
Oh my gosh.
And she loves chewing on everything, which at my house, because I don't have a garden because it's a rental, and I have not had time to put landscape plants into my landscape, not a huge issue. But I know that for people who do have garden plants, that can be a problem, especially if your dog or cat has a chewing habit where they go and chew on whatever they see.
Well, sure.
My dog really loves chewing on anything that is hanging down. And for certain plants, that can cause some serious health issues.
Oh, yeah.
If they chew on the wrong plant. So there are some plants that are toxic to both dogs and cats that you would definitely need to keep in mind if you have animals. I would definitely not say remove these plants for sure. If you do have them in your landscape and you have, animals that you want to keep safe, but it does take a little bit of extra vigilance. Those are going to be plants like azaleas and rhododendrons, boxwoods, buckeyes, burning bushes, pretty much any bulbs like daffodils or tulips, English ivy, especially for dogs, any member of the Allium genus, so onions, chives, garlic, and leeks, hollies, hydrangeas, yews and yucca. Those are some of the more common perennials or shrubs that you would need to keep an eye on. The ones that most affect dogs are going to be the onions, and yews are going to be toxic to everything. It does not take very, and that includes people as well, it does not take very much of a yew plant, especially if you're, going for leaves or seeds, to kill a person.
Really?
Yeah. It is, they have a chemical in the leaves and the seeds called taxine, which is, there's a lot of biochemistry involved, but basically it is a, stops your heart, essentially.
Wow.
And so if your dog chews on leaves, or if you're, for some reason you're chewing on leaves, it would not take very many. It would take about 16 leaves to kill an average person. So it is very, very toxic. So definitely, if you have yews, make sure that they are not somewhere that your dog frequents or, your cat frequents. Most of the other plants that are toxic to animals are going to just be mildly toxic. So they're going to cause severe gastrointestinal distress. They're not going to be potentially fatal outside of the onions for dogs and yews for pretty much everyone. There are some plants that are toxic only to cats but not to dogs, and that's going to include daylilies and true lilies. Daylilies are one of the most common plants that I've experienced in landscapes, especially when I was working in a landscaping company up in Johnson County. They're really good drought-tolerant plants, so daylilies are definitely worth having.
But they're hard to kill.
Oh, yeah, they're very hard to kill. They're one of the hardest plants to kill.
We were trying to get rid of some, and we were, mowing them down all the time, and they just kept coming up.
Oh, yeah, and that's because they are tubers, so they're most of the energy reserves are going to be below ground anyway. If you have cats, that is one that will affect cats but not dogs. There are quite a few plants that are safe for both dogs and cats, including crepe myrtles, which is good because there are a lot of crepe myrtles down here in southeastern Kansas. Bamboo, celosia or coxcomb, coral bells, and zinnias are some of the more common ones I've seen that are safe for pretty much any pets. There is a animal poison control center through the ASPCA. So if you think that your animal has gotten a hold of a plant that is toxic or is caught, or they are having symptoms of potentially consuming a toxic plant, you would want to call the Animal Poison Control Center, and they can get you more info on how to proceed. That number is 888-426-426 4435. They do dogs, they do cats, they also do horses. So that is good to know if you have any horses that might have potentially gotten a hold of a garden plant. Usually you're not keeping horses right next to the garden, but stranger things have happened.
Well, yeah, and we even think about like house plants and that sort of thing. And, you know, as a dog owner, I do keep a thing of activated charcoal on hand just in case, because, you know, you can call them and they'll tell you what to do. You know, in some cases you will want the animal to vomit. In other cases you don't. And, you know, the activated charcoal can be one of those things that I use. Just I'm like, well, I'm not really sure what they ate or something. So I've given it to them more than once. And the good thing on that is that you can't overdose necessarily on it. So it's just kind of one of the handy things that I keep in my tool bag, along with hydrogen peroxide.
Oh, yeah. Tastes nasty. I've had activated charcoal because I've accidentally poisoned myself a couple of times. But it is one of the best things you can have for poisonings.
And well, I mix it with peanut butter and he just gobbles it down.
Yep. Animal poisonings are going to be treated a lot of the same ways that human poisonings are treated. So there is a little bit of predictability in that. But yeah, the poison, the ASPCA Poison Control Center will definitely know more about whether or not you would need to, you know, induce vomiting, if activated charcoal on its own would work. Sometimes you might not know what type of plant your animal has ingested, and that can be pretty tricky. In that case, they are typically going to play it on the safe side and not induce vomiting, where you would, you know, watch for symptoms instead and basically not preventative, but
I know what you're talking about, proactive.
You basically just treat symptoms as they appear.
Sure.
If they appear.
Sure.
But if you do have any questions about plants that your animal might have ingested, getting in touch with your local extension office, if you can, would be able to help you identify plants that could potentially be causing the problems
Sure.
you're seeing. When you are designing a garden, doing it with animals in mind is sometimes known as petscaping. Mm. There are a couple of principles in terms of petscaping that you want to keep in mind in order to have a optimal relationship between your garden, your animals, and yourself. The first is obviously to look up any plants you already have to determine potential animal toxicity. The ASPCA website is going to have a list of the most common garden plants and whether or not they are going to be toxic to animals, to dogs, cats, and horses. And if they are toxic, any symptoms you would see if they were accidentally or intentionally ingested. You never know what animals are thinking. Plants with thorns and other physical defenses, like roses, for example, aren't typically recommended for places that animals will frequent, because I know that my dog has run face first into rose bushes a couple of times, and that can cause problems with eyesight if it catches the animal in just the right way on their face. Mulch is obviously going to be beneficial to every landscape, but when you do mulch in an animal frequented area, you want to make sure that the mulch is going to be natural with no artificial dyes. Typically cedar is going to be the best option. The dyes can't kill your pet, but your pet might still be sensitive to them.
Sure.
You also want to be careful with the chemicals that you spray. If you are trying to control weeds or bugs or anything like that, your dog could also be sensitive to them. Any chemical is going to have what's known as a re-entry interval, and every label is going to have at least a little bit of information on how it can affect people and how it can affect animals.
Gotcha. And, you know, I obviously we never really want poultry in the garden. That's always a disaster. But it seems like when I had chickens, whenever they did get into the garden and they ate everything, they didn't really seem to have any ill effects. But chickens don't really seem to be as sensitive to a lot of these things from my experience.
Honestly, chickens are one great way of organic weed control. I know that when I was at K-State, my fruit production professor would keep chickens in the orchard Pittsburgh.
Really?
They would keep weeds off of the trees. They would also get any bugs that would try to crawl up the trunk. And I imagine that in more rural areas, it would be pretty similar.
I just didn't appreciate when they went down, nice radishes coming out of the ground, and bing, 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 bing,
bing. Oh,
yeah.
If you're trying to grow a food garden, that is definitely something you want to keep separate yeah. from everything else. But in landscapes, especially more heavily maintained landscapes, chemicals are probably going to be the most common form of control.
Sure.
You know, if possible, opt for non-chemical control options to maximize the safety of your pets.
Sure.
Pull weeds instead of spraying them. Shoot bugs off of your plants with a jet of water, like a strong hose. Fertilize using organic options if possible. Fertilizer is usually going to be the least impactful of the chemicals that you can apply to landscapes because, you know, they are trying to help things grow instead of kill them. If you have a compost bin, especially if you're putting food scraps in the compost bin, make sure that your animal can't get into the compost pile. And lastly, choose plants that can give your animal a lot of shade and water to keep them cool during the summer months. But those are some basic principles of design to make sure that your pets are enjoying the garden just as much as you are and that you don't run into any potential problems down the road.
Sure, absolutely.
Want to keep our four-legged friends healthy.
We do. And we are officially into October, and maybe the leaves are starting to fall off trees, partially just because they're so stressed and, you know, dry. But we will get some normal leaves coming off this time of year. So do you want to talk at all about that?
Sure, yeah. If you are lucky enough to still have leaves on your trees, I've had a lot of people call me about trees prematurely dropping their leaves. Usually that's going to be the result of a condition called marginal leaf scorch, which is really anything but marginal right now, especially on maples. But you should start seeing your trees start to change color as the days shorten and the temperature falls. That is a natural process of what are known as deciduous trees, and it is a sign that they are starting to go through their dormancy. You get a lot of different colors in the fall. You get reds, oranges, yellows, purples sometimes, if you're really lucky. They are a result of two different processes. Orange and yellow pigments are going to be present in the leaves at all times during the year, but the chlorophyll that causes the green color in leaves is going to outshine, essentially, those pigments until the chlorophyll starts getting destroyed in the fall. And once the green chlorophyll is destroyed, then those oranges and yellows can take center stage. And so that's why we get a changing of the leaves. Reds and purples, on the other hand, are actually going to be produced by the tree during the fall. And that's going to be a result of high sugar production. The more vibrant a tree's color is usually down to the weather that you have in the month or so preceding tree dormancy or the activation of tree dormancy. So stronger, brighter light, like we've had this year, will result in more sugar production by the chlorophyll because they are, you know, in a last second rush to get as much sugar into the tree as possible to help it survive the winter. And so when you have the really bright light, you can expect to see some pretty vibrant colors in the trees.
That's almost the opposite of what I would expect for whatever reason.
Yeah. So hopefully we will have the most vibrant fall colors we've ever seen.
That'd be great. Now, at least one icing on the cake. But I'm thinking in the Northeast, we have these maps that come out of kind of peak leaf color time for people who are going to watch the leaves. Why does it seem, you know, they never even give us a map for Kansas. It's always like, seems like a longer, more extended period in the Northeast, whereas out here, it's like, it almost seems like we have about 2 or 3 days of great color, and then it's boom, over. Is there a reason for that?
Oh, there could be a number of reasons for that. In my experience, we in southeastern Kansas have moodier weather, I guess is a good way to put it, where we have swings of, you know, high and low temperatures pretty close together. The I'm from Kansas City. The weather that we've had up there, at least in my experience, is typically going to be less extreme.
Okay.
Not as pendulum-like as what we have down here. And when I say pendulum-like, that includes rain, that includes day and night temperatures and the like. So,
and I'm sure, you know, places like Maine are going to have completely different weather patterns. And what I would think.
Yeah, I was up in New Hampshire last week, last week. Sheesh, it's only been a week. And their trees had already pretty much changed color.
Okay.
So the difference in hardiness zones and, you know, how quickly they, the temperature drops up there, it was only about 50 degrees during the middle of the day when I was there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, there's quite a significant difference when it comes to latitude. And that would explain at least a little bit of why they're typically going to be more predictable in when their leaves change colors, because they are a much smaller state.
Sure. That does make sense. Okay.
I think they only have two hardiness zones in New Hampshire, for example, whereas Kansas has four.
Okay.
And that is a gradient from northwest to southeast. So northwest is typically going to be the coolest during the winter, driest. Southeast is going to be the warmest and the wettest during the summer, winter.
Well, we're heading towards the bottom of the hour, but what else do you want to add to this discussion on fall leaves?
Sure. So a few people have asked me what they should do with their fall leaves. You know, should they mulch? Should they compost them? You can do pretty much anything. As I mentioned in the top half of the program, you do want to be careful when adding organic matter like mulch back into your yard, because you do get that excessive thatch buildup and trees can put off a lot of leaves.
Yeah.
And so you would likely want to alternate bagging and not bagging if you did want to mulch. Compost pile is a really good choice for leaves, because compost, in order to be successful, needs three times as much brown matter as it does green. And fallen leaves count as brown.
Okay.
So you will need a good amount of leaf litter in order to start an optimal compost pile. Obviously, you can compost with, you know, less than ideal ratio of organic matter, but in order to get the fastest decay rate from the bacteria that are going to be living in your compost pile, you would want about three times as much carbon as nitrogen, and the leaves are going to be that carbon source. So mowing over leaves is always going to be the best choice, if whether you're mulching with them in the yard or you are using them in compost. Breaking up the pieces into smaller chunks will help it decay faster and more evenly. So mow over it. If you've got a bag for your mower, bag the clippings, at least for some of them, and then add them to a compost pile. Fall is actually a great time to start a compost pile because you have so many leaves. For some reason, you mulch, you have a compost pile, and you still have more leaves, you would want to take the excess leaves to a burn pile, a city compost pile, or some kind of fire pit, which shouldn't be a problem for the winter. You know, people want to stay warm, so fire pits, fireplaces, things like that. You do want to be careful if you do use leaves in a fireplace. It puts off quite a bit of smoke, so you want to make sure that your fire is well ventilated.
Yeah, open that flue before you start.
yep. You do not want to smoke yourself out of your house in the dead of winter when it could be very cold out and you would not want to have to evacuate. But that's just kind of a basic overview of fall leaves. One final thing to mention. If you are thinking about buying a tree from a nursery or garden center, wait until the fall, because at that point, when you're at the nursery or garden center, you will be able to see a general idea of what the color of the tree you're looking at is going to be like. You can make selections based on the most vibrant colors that you see at the garden center. And so that's one way to ensure that you have the nicest looking tree for your landscape.
And also the kind of, you know, nuts and seeds and leaves that it's going to be dropping, because you're going to be the one picking those up more than likely.
Yep, definitely. And so if you did want to avoid a lot of leaves, opt for a bigger leaf.
Yeah. Locust. No locust trees.
Yeah, oh, no. Oh. Locust. I would say no locust trees for a completely different reason. But in general, if you want big leaves that are less messy in the fall, sycamores and tulip poplars are two of the best choices.
Okay. And with that, we are going to leave it there, because we're headed to Fox News at the bottom of the hour. Chris Freund will be here for Open Line, so look forward to him. Jesse, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to see you again face-to-face, and I look forward to the next time you come in.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.